Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with the Week in Review for Saturday, March 14th. Well, we finally had a rally, but first, Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao said, "Confidence is more important than gold or money. First and foremost, we need very strong confidence. Only when we have confidence can we have courage and strength, and only when we have courage and strength can we overcome difficulties." Warren Buffett said, "I've never seen Americans more fearful and confused." While global equity investors, at least for a few days, caught a break this week, the drumbeat of bad news and forecasts continued, and as the first two note, it says much about a lack of confidence as it is the fundamentals worldwide. It's also about the lack of leadership in instilling confidence. Both Merrill Lynch economist David Rosenberg and the New York Times' Paul Krugman lamented that the Obama stimulus plan was too small and too cautious, and it needed to be a lot bolder. Krugman worried the Obama administration's economic policies are already falling behind the curve. Rosenberg said we would have been better off handing out a $1 trillion interest-free loan to the states and local governments who employ 20 million people, like cops, teachers, firefighters, construction workers, rather than what we ended up with. The World Bank ratcheted down its global forecast yet again to negative growth for 2009, the first time the economy will shrink since World War II, as trade will see its worst decline in 80 years. President Robert Zoellick said, "We need to react in real time to a growing crisis that is hurting people in developing countries. Global industrial production is expected to be as much as 15% lower than in 2008. The rate of poverty is increasing rapidly." Over last weekend and into Monday, there was increased talk of depression. Economists started to define it more specifically than before, such as a 10% decline in per capita GDP and consumption, or a two-year period with unemployment of at least 10%. The consensus among the depression set seem to be that the odds are 1 in 4 or 1 in 3. The economic news in the U.S. was light this week, though importantly, retail sales down just 0.1% for February and up ex autos continued a favorable trend of seeming stability. Globally, however, you had awful manufacturing figures out of Europe, with orders in Germany down 38% year over year, while exports there in January plunged 20%, with an economist saying the annual slump is absolutely catastrophic, the extent of deliveries terrifying. France saw its industrial production drop 13.8% in January, and Britain's fell 5.6% for the 3 months ending January. Industrial production in Sweden plummeted 23% for the month versus year-ago levels. In Asia, Malaysia's exports fell 28% in January, an unheard-of level. They all are, actually. And in Japan, fourth quarter GDP was revised to reflect a 12.1% annualized decline, actually a slight improvement on the earlier flash number, but still dreadful. Producer prices in Japan were down 1.1% for February versus a year ago, a troubling sign of deflation. China showed its own signs of deflation as consumer prices dropped 1.6% in February. Exactly a year ago, though, we were talking of prices rising 8.5% there. But otherwise, China's picture was decidedly mixed, which in and of itself provides a bit of hope. Industrial production was up 3.8% for January and February, though it declined from December's pace, as auto sales rose 25% in February and fixed investment for January and February climbed 26.5%, as the impact of the government stimulus plan, one that focuses on roads, railways, and housing, took hold. Retail sales for January, February in China rose 15.9%, though this was actually a disappointment. Chinese Premier Wen emphasized he still felt his government could deliver 8% growth, below which every American schoolchild should know by now the leaders fear instability and unrest. And Wen promised to spend more than the existing $600 billion stimulus package if necessary. Some say China is laying the groundwork for a V-shaped recovery, while others in Japan are calling for a pickup in the second quarter there because inventories are being slashed to the bone. We keep hearing the mantra, around the world, the economy is falling off a cliff, but in some cases, it's as if the patient is catching that tree branch on the way down to death and depression, after which it is hoped he will be choppered out of harm's way. So it was against this backdrop that stocks suddenly took off after hitting new 12-year lows on Monday, 65.47 for the Dow Jones on a closing basis and 6.76 for the S&P 500. The S&P actually hit 666 as an intraday low, which was rather interesting. By the close on Friday, however, the Dow had risen to 72.23 and the S&P 756. So why the rally? That, for one, pleased your editor, who was taking a lot of grief recently for his more bullish stance in terms of 09 asset allocation. It started with bullish comments from Citigroup CEO Vikram Pandit, who said Citi was profitable on an operating basis for January and February. Forget that this excluded further loan loss reserves and write-downs for both its consumer and mortgage exposures. We'll take any good news where we can find it. Pandit's comment started a stampede, slight exaggeration, of other bank execs saying we too are doing just fine, with J.P. Morgan Chase's Jamie Dimon noting some prodding, needing some prodding from CNBC to give the all clear at his shop, while Bank of America's Ken Lewis, who always looks like his shorts are too tight, rushed to the gate to say we're profitable too. Of course, they are all far from healthy and still in intensive care, as is the entire global economy. But at least the banks, save UBS it seems, offered up a ray of sunshine and the hope that further capital infusions may not be necessary, unless under the bank's terms, which would be a pleasant switch. General Motors then said, hey, we've examined the impact of all our cost-cutting, and since we have just four workers left, an amazingly productive quartet, I might add, we don't need $2 billion in federal funds for March. And General Electric, which traded below $6 on March 4, rallied strongly to $9.50, even though it lost its AAA rating from S&P because the downgrade wasn't worse. Then you had the growing belief that something was going to be done about mark-to-market accounting, which, if suspended or repealed, should have a most positive effect on the financials, that then wouldn't have to raise new capital and dilute shareholders further. Bottom line, for a week at least, talk of bank nationalization was set aside for another day. I've been saying that as bad as things are, at some point we'd have a change in sentiment that could lead to an explosive rally. This week's action was just a harbinger of what we'll see at some point, but whether it is in the first or second half of 2009, I don't know. For now, what we do know is that while for 1 week Washington's impact was suspended when it came to the stock market, its impact going forward will once again be paramount. Both Wall and Main Street's demand that our government act boldly. Robert Samuelson of Newsweek commented, confidence too little and uncertainty too much are at the core of this crisis. All of Obama's double talk threatens to reduce the first and raise the second. Investors and traders have surely noticed the discrepancies between Obama's words and actions. Obama says he's focused single-mindedly on reviving the economy, but he's also using the crisis as a vehicle to advance an ambitious long-term agenda to re-engineer the U.S. economy. The two sometimes collide. The $787 billion stimulus is weaker than necessary because almost $200 billion of the impact occurs after 2010. Many of these extended projects, such as high-speed rail and computerized medical records, can't be accomplished quickly. When Congress debates Obama's sweeping health care and energy proposals, industries, regions, and governmental philosophies will clash. Will this improve confidence, reduce uncertainty? Samuelson continues, a prudent president would have made a tough choice. Concentrated on the economy, deferred his more contentious agenda. Similarly, Obama claims to seek bipartisanship, but in reality doesn't. His bipartisanship consists of sprinkling his cabinet with token Republicans and inviting some Republican members of Congress to the White House to watch the Super Bowl. It does not consist of fashioning proposals that would attract bipartisan support on their merits. Instead, he clings to dubious partisan policies, such as mortgage cram-downs and union checkoffs, that arouse further opposition. Samuelson concludes, it is Obama's conceit, perhaps his cockiness, that he can ignore these blatant inconsistencies. Like many smart people, he believes he can talk his way around any problem. Perhaps he can. In this, he has an ally in much of the mainstream media, which seems so enthralled with him that they can't recognize glaring contradictions. During the campaign, Obama claimed he would change Washington's petty partisanship. He also advocated a highly partisan agenda. Both claims could not be true. The media barely noticed. The same obliviousness persists. But Obama still runs a risk that his overworked rhetoric loses its power and boomerangs on him. For the week, the Dow and S&P rocketed to their best performance since November. The Dow Jones surging 9%, the S&P 500 10.7%, and NASDAQ 10.6%. NASDAQ's loss for the year is back down below 10%, but the losses for the other indices are still huge year to date. Over the weekend, there is a G20 meeting of finance ministers ahead of a critical G20 summit of world leaders in April. And Ben Bernanke grants a rare interview to 60 Minutes, which would be worth watching. Anything to help educate the public is appreciated, and this should be useful. And finally, just a note on Bernie Madoff, who pleaded guilty Thursday to pulling off the greatest Ponzi scheme in the world and was let off in handcuffs to stay in prison until his sentencing June 16. His victims applauded. Madoff read a statement that said in part, "I am grateful for the opportunity to publicly comment about my crimes, for which I am deeply sorry and ashamed. As the years went by, I realized my risk, and this day would inevitably come." Whatever. DeWitt Baker, an investor who reportedly lost more than $1 million with Madoff, said, "I don't think he has a sincere bone in his body. I'd stone him to death." Frankly, I agree with the conclusion of CNBC commentator William Seidman, who offered, "We need capital punishment. One example, and this all would stop." It would appear there are certainly others involved, or at least with knowledge of Madoff's crimes, see wife Ruth. For example, the Wall Street Journal reported that a supervisor, Annette Bongiorno, would ask two assistants to research daily share prices for blue chip stocks Madoff was reportedly investing in for the purposes of generating fraudulent trade tickets. Prosecutors now estimate the fraud reached $64.8 billion, with only $1 billion recovered thus far, not the previous estimate of $50 billion, including phony profits Madoff claimed he had generated, as new evidence reveals that Madoff actually promised some clients 46% annualized returns. Madoff's net worth, incidentally, was set at $823 million in court papers. But since Madoff didn't cop to a conspiracy charge, investigators, at least until Madoff cries uncle in jail, will be on their own, as Bernie has thus far refused to rat out others. And that's your Week in Review for March 14th. You can catch the rest of it at stocksandnews.com. I'm Brian Trumbore, and I'll be with you next Saturday.